Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to tonight's event. My name is Jürgen Hake. I'm a faculty member of the International Relations Department here at the LSE. I'm also the director of the Saw Swee Hock Southeast Asia Center, the unit that is organizing tonight's event. I'm absolutely delighted to be able to welcome Professor Joseph Chin-Yung Liao to the LSE and SEAC this evening. Joseph is Dean and Professor of Comparative and International Politics at the Ratnam School of International Studies at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Recently, from 2014 to 2016, he was also the inaugural Lee Kuan Yew Chair in Southeast Asia Studies and a Senior Fellow at Brookings. He has a wide-ranging set of other affiliations. I'll only mention one, which is that he's also an advisory board member of the ASEAN Institute of Peace and Reconciliation. I'm very happy to say that he is, in addition to all of that, also an LSE alumnus, having graduated from the International Relations Department with a PhD in 2003. Now, students of Southeast Asia have for a long time focused on the various political conflicts and insurgencies that dot the region. Often, these conflicts are categorized as ethnic or religious in nature. Are such depictions helpful? To what extent can we say, with respect to Southeast Asian cases of internal contestation, that religious frames are the sole reference point of grievances and the driver of the main intrastate conflicts? Does the category of religious conflict tell us enough about the nature of the political projects and claims made by those that resist or, in some cases, vigorously defend incumbent power in contexts where diverse ethno-national communities inhabit the same territorially confined space set by state boundaries? What, in other words, is the relationship between religion and nationalism in intrastate conflict in Southeast Asia? I'm glad to say that having recently published a book on the subject, Professor Liao is better placed than most to help us address these questions. We will be able to learn a lot from him. Before we start this event, I'd just like to remind you to please put your phones on silent mode so that you don't disrupt the event and the proceedings. The event is being recorded, and we envisage making the recording available as a podcast subject to there being no technical difficulties. As usual, there will also be for you the chance to put questions to the speaker after the lecture. But now, will you please join me in welcoming Professor Joseph Liao back to LSE and to invite him to deliver his lecture entitled Religion and Nationalism in Southeast Asia, Conflict and Contestation in the Conception of Nationhood. Joseph.
Thank you, Jürgen. Good evening, everyone. Very kind, generous introduction. One thing Jürgen forgot conveniently to mention was that he was my examiner during my viva not too long ago, right? We just had a discussion about how young we are. And lo and behold, I'm back here again, and he's scrutinizing me again. So I just no escaping him, is there? But very good evening, everyone, and it gives me great pleasure to be back here in LSE, a place where is really known as a bastion of good scholarship on Southeast Asia and good scholarship on nationalism. So it's a pleasure to be able to try to marry these two traditions. And I try, and I probably failed miserably, but the very attempt itself was a joy for me, and particularly edifying in terms of writing this book. And so I've been invited to come here to share some thoughts from the book with you, which I'm very happy to. Let me start the story, really, by just sharing how I, not stumbled upon this topic, but how it really got me interested. And I want to start by just saying that it was really about 12 years ago. Yeah, about 12 years ago in 2004. So I found myself sitting in this coffee shop in Pattani, which is in the southern border provinces of Thailand. And I was there with a good friend of mine who has since passed on. He's a local civil society activist. And we were talking about the ongoing violence there. And he was doing a lot of work on the ground with local communities. And we were specifically talking about the events of 28 April that year, 2004, when 32 militants armed with machetes and a pistol were killed by the Thai military at the famous Krusek Mosque, or Krisek Mosque, as they call it locally. So I posed to him the question, why was the local Malay community so adamant and so persistent in their resistance against central authority through both armed as well as unarmed means? You know, after all, since the early 1990s, the southern provinces, the Malay Muslim provinces of Thailand, had been the beneficiaries of very generous developmental aid from the Thai government, and especially the Royal Palace. So my friend explained to me that the question, as far as he could tell, was not about modernization, development, or economic progress, but what he felt was more fundamental issues of identity, of belonging, and as they like to say in that area, being Islam. This disconnect weighed very heavily on my mind in the course of my many meetings with, on the other side of the coin, with Thai officials, military officials, government officials, even people from the intelligence services. These people who are charged with ensuring the security of the security in the southern provinces, and they all almost, without exception, would share with me their bewilderment at why the Malay Muslims continue to fight and were so ungrateful for the goodwill that Bangkok was bestowing upon them. So it's like two ships in the night, right, passing. A year later, drawn by what appeared to me as, at first glance, an obvious parallel, right, between what was happening in the deep south in Thailand and what I read was happening in the Philippines, I contacted another good friend of mine, Tom McKenna, who is an American anthropologist, and he helped me make contacts in Cotabato in Mindanao. And in that year, 2005, I made the first of a number of trips down to Cotabato, and there I had the privilege of meeting and working with Tom's interlocutors, who had helped him with his own research on Mindanao. Tom had written a book by the title of Muslim Rulers and Rebels, which I, in my own personal opinion, I still think is the finest study on political conflicts in southern Philippines today, and I commend it to you without hesitation. But anyway, it was not difficult to appreciate rather quickly how similar perceptions and misperceptions obtained between what was happening in Thailand and what was happening in the Philippines among the principal protagonists. So this set me on the path to attempt to understand the deep and complex historical dynamics that inform some of the intra-state conflicts that still persist in Southeast Asia. Now, we should recognize that Southeast Asia has come a long way. Those of you who work on the history or the Cold War history on the region will remember that people took to describing it as a region in revolt, among other less edifying terms or characterizations. But today, it is quite obviously one of the most dynamic economic regions in the world, yet it is at the same time also home to some of the most enduring post-colonial intrastate conflicts that continue to bedevil modern society. A brief look at the headlines and social media over the last decade and a half, I think is a good indicator of how this has cast a shadow over the region. In Myanmar, violence has broken out between Buddhists and Muslims, even as the country inches down the path of democratization. In Thailand and the Philippines, Muslim minorities in their respective southern provinces are purportedly waging a jihad or holy war against what we are told are majoritarian prejudices of predominantly Buddhist and Catholic states and societies, respectively. Malaysia is a country of particular interest to me, one which I have studied for more than two decades. While Malaysia has thus far had the good fortune of avoiding the outbreak of violence, the country nevertheless has witnessed an alarming escalation of tension as a Muslim-dominated government has allowed the expression of acutely exclusivist majoritarian views on religion in the name of defending the Islamic faith, and allowed these views to go unchecked. The deleterious effect of which has been the constriction of the religio-cultural space afforded to non-Muslims by a range of means, not least including reinterpretations of the Malaysian constitution itself. In Indonesia, another country which has intrigued me for years, as the story goes, post-Suharto political transformation allowed 100 flowers to bloom, right? But democratization and political liberalization also possessed a dark side that found expression in the rise of sectarianism and religious intolerance, the latest incident being the pressure currently exerted on the Indonesian government to convict the beleaguered non-Muslim ethnic Chinese Christian governor of Jakarta, Ahok, or Basuki Jaja Purnama, for the crime of blasphemy. In fact, in Indonesia, these tensions have boiled over to violence, not only between Muslims and non-Muslims, but within Indonesia's kaleidoscopic Muslim community as well, as the plight of the Shia and the Ahmadiyya communities would attest. Now, what is readily evident at first glance, is that there's a common thematic thread that appears to weave its way through many of these conflicts, and that is the role of religion. In brief, many of these conflicts appear intuitively religious in nature by virtue of the frequent use of religious symbols, metaphors, narratives to describe them. We see this in the popular media, in academia, and most significantly among some of the conflict actors themselves. Furthermore, if media reports and political statements are any indication, religious conflicts in Southeast Asia are nothing short of the incendiary acts of extremist religious groups waged against followers of other religions and faiths, perhaps even against others professing the same creed. Or it represents the wholesale rejection of modernity by such groups. These perspectives are often ventriloquized in keynote speeches and populist literature, where elegant explanations are predicated on clichés and catchphrases such as anti-modernity, cosmic wars, and, the most famous of all, clash of civilizations. Underpinning such views is the perspective that religion is predisposed to violence. This is a view that has gained considerable currency in many quarters. Now, it is not my intention tonight to defend religion or to debunk the arguments of those who posit and defend this sort of causal relationship, but I do wish to point out that such explanations do little more than obscure and caricature what are in fact very complex issues. Indeed, given the popularity and appeal of such views in the current milieu, a proper understanding of the role of religion in these conflicts, I think, is both necessary and urgent, lest one makes the same mistake one accuses religious extremists of making, namely to subscribe to very tidy and simplistic, but ultimately baseless and misinformed ideas. Now, bearing these issues in mind, my lecture this evening will attempt to shed some light on the following question. How should one endeavour to understand the role of religion in some of the intrastate conflicts in Southeast Asia? I'll begin by making a case for why religion and nationalism are important elements to the study of many of these intrastate conflicts. The second part of the lecture will consider the nexus between religion and nationalism. The third and final part will look specifically at how the imperatives of faith and flag manifest in several examples in Southeast Asia. And of course, if I can make a plug, it's based on a book that I had just authored, which is reasonably priced, I think. Now, okay, on to the matter at hand. When scholars try to deduce what causes conflicts, there is often a tendency to confuse the matter with the apparent cognate question of why groups and movements engage in conflicts. Now, though seemingly cognate, these are in fact two different issues, and the danger is to confuse which is the product and which the presupposition of an argument. My point is that while religion may cause contestations and conflicts may be waged in defense of God and creed, more often than not, religion may not necessarily be what the fight is about. And to cast them as merely cases of religious or sectarian strife threatens to miss the proverbial forest for the trees. Put differently, it is erroneous to assume that conflicts are religious in nature simply because they appear religious in manifestation. Now, to be sure, to suggest that religion plays a prominent role in politics hardly counts as a novel or path-breaking claim, at least in the field of political science and conflict studies. The current literature is attended by a rich coverage on debates that meander across themes such as the global resurgence of religion, jihadi violence and new, that is to say, religiously motivated terrorism, clash of civilizations, inter-religious conflict, not necessarily limited to, but certainly dominated by the monotheistic religions, all of which explore one facet or another of the nexus between religion, conflict, and politics. To my mind, the point of departure is over whether religious belief lies at the core of the problem of political conflict. In my lecture, I hope to convince you that should one take the argument that religion is the main cause or driver of at least some of these conflicts claiming authenticity in deity and piety, one would be fundamentally missing the point. For such a perspective betrays a misunderstanding of both the role and place of religion in Southeast Asian societies and the fundamental drivers of many of these conflicts. My argument turns on the premise that far from efforts of some scholars to draw what is ultimately a false distinction between the religious and the secular, religion has always been a key component of identity in many Southeast Asian societies. And because religion is a key component of individual and collective identity, it stands to reason that religion can play and indeed has played an important role in providing a framework for interpreting political events and a normative language for articulating purpose in response to these events. In Southeast Asian society, whether pre-modern or indeed contemporary, religion is not just superstition or a set of doctrines, but a lived historical experience that cannot be separated from politics and the secular. For instance, is it possible to divorce notions of kingship and political authority from the Hindu-Buddhist cosmos or the Islamic faith in pre-modern maritime Southeast Asia? Fast forward to the anti-colonial nationalist movements. How many of them, whether in Burma, the Dutch East Indies, or British Malaya, had their origins in religious orders or movements and were led by local religious elite? Consider too the rich and diverse religio-political narratives of the Indo-Malay world captured in concepts such as Pancasila, Islam Nusantara, Piagam Jakarta, Masyarakat Madani, and Islam Hadari, or in Thailand, Chat Sasana Pramahakasat, Nation, Religion, King. These concepts speak not only about confessional creeds and deity, but also present ideas on how society, modern society, should be organized and how politics should be conducted, rightly or wrongly. Hence, religion and religious narratives in this sense speak to broader concerns that relate not so much to confessional beliefs or doctrine, important as these matters are, but to questions of identity, nationhood, legitimacy, and belonging. In keeping with this train of thought, the process of national identity and consciousness framing and construction is therefore imperative for efforts to better understand the religious character of some political conflicts and contestations we see in the region. And this is what really interests me. Now, why religion and nationalism? Religion and nationalism, to my mind, are two of the most potent and enduring socio-political forces that have shaped our modern world. Indeed, few ideas have commanded as much loyalty. For faith and flag, countless men and women have, over the course of modern history, willingly spilled blood and sacrificed, as well as taken lives. All the more so in Southeast Asia, where religious identities have proven as strong and as resilient as nationalist impulses. Permit me at this juncture to spend a few minutes dwelling on religion and nationalism and how they intersect. While modernization and secularization theory confidently predicted an erosion of religion in the civil sphere, a cursory glance at the world today readily proves such predictions premature, if not fundamentally misguided. In fact, religion has proven that it is not the archaic cultural artifact existing as an anachronism in modern society, as some might contend, but rather is very much part of a community's negotiation of its identity in the context of modernity. To this, I would add further that the emergence of secular and modern nationalism did not come about as a result of the demise of religion, but rather the renegotiation and refashioning of the relationship between religion, nationalism, and the state. The most obvious evidence of this can be found in the very process of European state formation and the struggle for power between the church and civil authority between the 15th and 17th centuries, where scholars have made the case that even as religion was reinvented as a private sphere separate from the secular world of politics, it was the church that paved the way for the emergence of modern and secular nationalism in how it provided national symbols and delineated the boundaries of national identity. The historian Simon Walker's observation of how successive kings promoted national and dynastic unity through the medium of a revitalized public religion is hence instructive in this regard. And it is this contingent separation of church and state that gets exported worldwide, as the story goes, through the enterprise of empire and colonialism. Yet upon reaching Southeast Asian shores, the artificiality of this notion that church or mosque or temple and state can be separated into different and independent realms very quickly became evident. I had earlier mentioned how in Southeast Asia, what we understand as religion has always been a crucial component of Southeast Asian society. I say what we understand as religion because the definition of religion is itself a hotly debated subject that remains unresolved. And I would submit to you that the concept of religion was in fact quite alien to indigenous Southeast Asian thinking prior to the advent of empire and colonialism for reasons already mentioned. One can immediately discern some resonance with state formation in Southeast Asia, where religion and politics has overlapped in some way, shape or form. Myanmar and Thailand comes to mind, where the Buddhist Sangha underpinned the foundations of the modern state. Or Malaysia, where constitutional tension between religious, red Islamic authority and the non-Muslim right to freedom of worship coloured to a considerable extent the narrative of Malay nationalism, the consequences of which are still being felt today. Indeed, as Sudipta Kaviraj explained in her work on Thick and Thin Religion, quote, "When faced with the challenges of modernity, traditional forms do not drop their weapons and die. Some of these groups ignore their historical duty to decline and find unreasonable ways of adapting and even flourishing in the new cultural ecology," unquote. I would like to put to you that religion animates three key elements of nationalism. First, the idea of the state as a political legal entity. Second, the nation, which is or is taken to be a community of people sharing in some important way a common culture, contrived or otherwise. And 3, the nation state, which is a nation or possibly a collection of nations organized and governed as a territorial state. Another way of putting it, these three constituent elements of nationalism speak to and correspond with legitimacy and governance, collective identity, and nation statehood in terms of who is included and who is excluded. The second part of my lecture dwells on each of these three forms and how they resonate across Southeast Asia. Now, legitimacy is a critical component of nationalism because it essentially poses the imperative question, by whom should one be ruled and on what terms? In answering this question, it can be hypothesized that one reason why some states struggle to create a sense of we-ness can be attributed to a deficit in legitimacy or an absence of legitimacy altogether. This happens when the authors of the predominant conception of nationhood fail to obtain buy-in and acceptance of their view of, to obtain buy-in and acceptance of the view that their official construction of national identity should supersede other identity signifiers that their populations may possess. Equally pertinent to nationalism is the matter of the existence of a resilient and resonant collective identity. By drawing attention to nationalism, and more specifically, the terms and process through which national identities are conceived and constructed, a process which we can term the conception of nationhood, one needs to consider competing conceptions of nationhood not only as they relate to physical space in several Southeast Asian cases, but ideational and ideological space as well, in order to bring into sharper focus the role of religion and how it relates to contestations that occur within the contours of national identity and state building. Finally, implicit in this is a suggestion that in most cases, the political cultural entity called the nation is not and has never been consonant with the political juridical entity of the state. Even the most homogeneous nation states today have significant minorities who may not share in the majority's all-encompassing conception of nationhood. Indeed, it is this fact that compels one to give heed to alternative conceptions of nationhood in one's analysis, in addition to the official nationalisms and their underlying narratives through which independent Southeast Asian states came into being. Now, having sketched out the contours and analytical parameters, how do these patterns manifest in Southeast Asia? In Southeast Asia, religiously inspired narratives that frame conceptions of nationhood have found expression in various forms. Some are part of national history sanctioned by the state, while others express subaltern histories. Some are articulated explicitly, while others implicitly. Narratives have changed and been reframed, whether to legitimize resistance or discredit it. But I found that they all point to one thing: the use of religion in the narrative itself to trigger collective memory and experiences. In both Mindanao and the southern provinces of Thailand, for instance, contrary to the unfounded speculations of alarmist pundits, what is being liberated by the Bangsamoro and Malay jihadists is not some abstract transnational caliphate, but a historical, territorially and culturally bound entity, imagined or otherwise. Furthermore, the reason for the move to liberate these kingdoms lies in the perceived illegitimacy of the central state, measured by their inability or reluctance to accept the Bangsamoro and the Malay Muslims as separate nations within the territorial state, and by their treatment as inferior members of the respective political social entities. Put differently, conflict has been a response to the difficulty or reluctance of official Thai and Philippine nationalism to accommodate local conceptions of nationhood, or even to countenance what Montserrat Gubernau calls a nation without a state. In Mindanao, religious discourse has been used to frame grievances over land loss and marginalization. In fact, as an aside, this is the one issue that is posing the sternest test for those who have been tasked to draw up the Bangsamoro Basic Law, which is still sitting at the Philippine Congress waiting to be passed, but not likely to be passed anytime soon. Yet at the same time, references to confessional faith and creed have also been reframed by the leadership of the Moral Islamic Liberation Front to rationalize and explain the decision to bring hostilities against the Philippine state to an end, despite falling short of the objective of the creation of an Islamic state in the dogmatic sense, an objective for which we are told a moral jihad has been purportedly waged for decades, if not longer. An analogous phenomenon, albeit within a different context and with its own twists, can be discerned in the Malay Muslim narratives that frame conflict in Thailand's southern provinces. According to these narratives, conflict with the Thai state flows from historical narratives of conquest and subjugation at the hands of a hegemonic central state portrayed as a Buddhist colonial power. Cue here the presence of the Phayathani canon, the Sri Patani canon in Malay. It is the largest of 42 canons on display outside the very large Ministry of Defense building. According to the Malay Muslim narrative, this canon was captured by the Siamese army during the 1786 conflict that led to the subjugation of the kingdom of Patani Darussalam. And resistance has essentially been framed with reference to cultural identity and ethnic distinctiveness, which religion serves to amplify. All this concentrated in the symbolism of the canon and where it is located. It appears then that the struggle is cut from the same cloth of anti-colonial resistance movements prevalent during the Cold War, only this time it is using religion as an idiom of nationhood. At any rate, because religious identity and specifically Islamic identity in both the case of Mindanao and southern Thailand weigh so heavily in their histories, as well as the ethnic and cultural self-conceptions and collective memories of the respective communities, it should hardly be surprising to find that religion has been employed to animate historical narratives. Yet equally evident is the fact that despite the universalistic appeal of the Islamic faith, in Mindanao and the southern Thai provinces, the scope of religious conflict has been decidedly limited and remarkably parochial in the latter case, in the case of Thailand, which I'm very happy to get into at greater length during the question and answer. Not only that, the fact that there are at times also degrees of variation within the collective's own narratives of religious nationalism further indicates that the phenomenon itself is far more complex than simple recourse to piety. In other words, Bangsa Moro and Patani mythopoeia belies the absence of a singular Bangsa Moro or Malay Muslim narrative. Now, this point highlights the reality that the construction of identity along religious lines is also contested within the in-group itself, as is evident in the dissonances within the religious nationalist movements and narratives. Heretofore, nationalists will claim to speak for the communities they represent and oftentimes present the identities and narratives that frame them as coherent and consistent. In truth, the situation is far more ambiguous, and even resistance frames may and oftentimes are contested from several quarters within the communities they purport to represent. The point to stress here again is the interactive and dynamic nature of conceptions of nationhood, where this dynamic and contingent feature of religion belies modernist attempts to dismiss its purported antediluvian and primordial nature. One can further illustrate such contextualization with reference to Malaysia and Indonesia. In Indonesia, with regards to the dynamics between Islamisasi and Christianisasi, Islamization and Christianization, a process traced to the 1970s when Christians were seen to be on the political ascent with Suharto's endorsement, resistance was triggered by the perception that indigenous rights of a Muslim-dominant society were being undermined with the conjunction of interests between the New Order State and its Christian and nominal Muslim allies, at least up to the 1980s. Whereas political transition after the fall of Suharto, was seen to offer up opportunities to rectify this imbalance, indeed to renegotiate the place of religion in Indonesian conceptions of nationhood in terms of its primacy. The ongoing case against Ahok is merely the latest iteration of this long-drawn dynamic. In Malaysia, on the other hand, Malay Islamic nationalists have essentially commandeered the levers of state power and sought to use them as a vehicle to impose their conception of nationhood and legitimacy onto non-Malay Muslim minorities on the grounds that Malay Muslim dominance is the cornerstone of the Malaysian nation-state. Today, this is most evident in UMNO's support for the past President Abdul Hadi Awang's private members' bill to reform the Sharia Court Criminal Jurisdiction Act of 1965, also known as Act 355, to empower Islamic courts to enforce punishment provided in Sharia laws for Islamic offences. It's always interesting to talk to the enlightened ulama who came up with these suggestions, whether or not it covers non-Muslims, and they're not very sure themselves. You know, so I think therein lies one of the concerns for the non-Muslim minority in Malaysia. In both Malaysia and Indonesia, majoritarian Muslim impulses to renegotiate and recast the post-colonial premises of nationhood have in turn prompted counter-mobilization in defense of minority rights as equal citizens and members of the nation, amplifying tensions in the process. The task of constructing national identity in Malaysia has proven to be especially onerous, despite the fact that tensions between competing conceptions of nationhood have yet to break out into open hostilities. In Malaysia, the fundamental premise of the state, which in Malaysia basically means political parties aligned along ethnic lines, such that identity differences are actually formally institutionalized and perpetuated, and society, namely social structures predicated on ethnic compartmentalization going as far back as the colonial era. This tension renders the task almost insurmountable, given how legitimacy is built on the blatant assertion of a majoritarian identity to the point of outright marginalization and discrimination. Indeed, these obstacles have led a prominent scholar of Malaysia to conclude that the country cannot claim with any confidence to be in possession of a national identity. This despite a public discourse replete with celebratory salutes to Malaysian multiculturalism in the form of slogans such as Bangsa Malaysia and One Malaysia. An added element that further complicates the already complex exercise of national identity formation in Malaysia is the fusion of ethnic and religious identity that has deepened over the past two decades in a country where ethnic boundaries are already heavily politicized and where the dominant Malay community or the political leaders of the dominant Malay community continues to grapple with the bipolar paradox of a sense of supremacy born of a presumed right to dominate on one hand and an acute, if somewhat misguided, perception of vulnerability and insecurity on the other. The challenge that this poses has been compounded by the existence of a monological as opposed to dialogical ideal of nationhood, which increasingly denies the claims of those who are not members of the Malay Muslim nation, the penumpang, as they call it, to equal status within the Malaysian state. Although not as explicit or as official, a somewhat similar script is playing out in Thailand, where the terminology of KHAEK, K-H-A-E-K, continues to be used by Thais to refer to Malay Muslims from the southern provinces, and in Indonesia, where the place and rights of followers, for example, of the Muslim Ahmadiyya sect, as members of the Indonesian Muslim nation are being contested on grounds of their unorthodox understandings of the faith. Conversely, one is encouraged by how the concept of Bangsa Moro, once used to define difference in southern Philippines, is now being used as a bridge, curiously enough, at least in theory, between Muslim, Christian and Lumat, which are the indigenous identities. In essence then, religious nationalists have recognized the value of religious identity and history and seek to harness their emotive power on the basis that their conception of nationhood needs to be defended and perpetuated. One should be careful not to simply dismiss this as mere instrumentalism or opportunism, for the emotive power upon which rests the mobilizing potential of religious nationalism was not conjured by them, but rather triggered in the collective memory of the people. And because narratives are socially constructed and marginally bound by fact most of the times, the mythopoetic faculty of nationalists allow them to make leaps in order to create, sustain, and reshape the sense of self and others, thereby creating the notorious othering effect. That is why nationalists and political leaders invest much attention and energy to constantly invent and reinvent the past, even as they frame and reframe the future in order to accomplish their presumed manifest destiny. Now to conclude, in Southeast Asia, religion shares a complicated and intricate relationship with both the nation and the state. Religion has played a considerable, indeed vital and dynamic role in the process of the imagination and construction of the nation, as well as in motivating conflict that results from competing conceptions of nationhood. The basis of this has been the consequential role that religion plays in the cultural and historical narratives through which identity is interpreted and mobilized. That religion has proven imperative in the formation and sustenance of the nation through its shaping of national identity, often serving as a bedrock for nation building, is evident in the cases of Thai, Malaysian and Indonesian official nationalism, with the Philippines being a possible exception. The early nationalists of the Dunia Melayu, the Malay world, or even from the Cao Dai movement in Vietnam at the turn of the 20th century, or the Buddhist clergy in Burma during British colonial rule from 1824 to 1948, were mostly religious leaders. In the Dutch East Indies and colonial Malaya, the early nationalists were religious movements that drank from the wellsprings of Islamic reform taking place in the Middle East at the turn of the last century. At the same time, religious identities have also emerged to challenge and undermine the nation as defined by the post-independent state. This has been shown in how intrastate conflicts framed in religious languages have played out and the strains they have created. This dynamic has taken diverse forms, from the Malay-Muslim armed struggle in Thailand's deep south to the peaceful but no less substantial pulpit mobilization movement that has been taking place across churches in Malaysia since 2008 in defense of the constitutional right to freedom of worship. Intriguingly, the logic can even work at cross purposes for minority communities depending on context and circumcise. Juxtapose, for example, the inconvenience of loyalty to the Thai flag for the Malay Muslim residing in Thailand's southern province with the convenience of Indonesian citizenship for a member of the Ahmadiyya in Indonesia, which allows them to claim the legal state of being Muslim despite the denial of that identity marker to them by many Indonesian Muslim groups, including several fatwas that were issued against them. The manner in which confessional identity negotiates, competes with, and coheres to conceptions of nationhood in the modernist project of imagining the nation within the territorial state points to the fact that religion is hardly the antithesis of modernity that secularist scholars would make it out to be, certainly in the case of Southeast Asia. Instead, non-Western societies such as those in Southeast Asia have melded their cultural cores, ergo religious identities, with Western modernity in the process of imagining identity as a nation, however imperfect or incomplete. Nor should it be inferred that by adapting, these societies have arrived at the end of history any more than Western societies themselves. Far from it, for religious nationalism can be as divisive as modernity itself. But the more important point to stress is that religious conflict is not a visceral, primordial reaction to modernity. Rather, it is the very outcome of the process of adaptation where attempts to conceive of and reconcile nationhood and statehood in Southeast Asia are defined, negotiated, and contested in the language of religion. So with this, I will end, and we can have an open discussion.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that brilliant lecture, Joseph.